Welcome to Ever Beyond. On Wolf Spirit Radio, Ever Beyond Radio, and Tir na Sao in Ireland. Be prepared to leave your belief systems behind as we go beyond teachers, beyond gurus, beyond duality, ever beyond. Please join us in the chat room at www.wolfspiritradio.com/listen. You're listening to Wolf Spirit Radio.
You are. It is the 7th month, the 3rd day, the 16th year of the second millennium, it appears, in this illusion of time that we call reality. Anyway, welcome to Ever Beyond. Good morning, good evening, good afternoon, good wakening. Yeah, if you're awake, thank you. somewhere on the surface of this rotating globe, there you are. And so today I'm going to be speaking with a gentleman who got in touch with me following, as I said a couple of shows ago with Simon. He said one word 2 weeks ago and this whole kind of phenomenon just kind of exploded. And I think in terms of that, my guest today exemplifies, and hopefully we will be able to have a very good data exchange interaction and mutual learning situation as we bring different parts of the matrix together to understand what is going on or what went on. So, to that end, without further ado, my guest today is Glenn Murphy. And since I know as much about you as the people who are listening to us, would you like to give us, well, first of all, welcome, and would you like to kind of give us a little background about from the position of where you're speaking from?
Sure, JP. Thumbnail bio, I'm a guy who grew up in the 60s. I was literally in grade school from 1960 through 1968, so that's and graduated high school in 72. And I had good fortune of growing up on the coast of California then. Carmel, Pebble Beach, Big Sur, Santa Cruz, pretty much Big Sur to the Fillmore West was our beat, I and my contemporaries. I had the remarkable fortune of growing up in a very wealthy area, Carmel and Pebble Beach, and most of my friends were of that ilk in that their families were, what we say in polite circles, wealthy. You never use the word rich there. And so I had a very smooth ride in my upbringing, had tremendous advantage, never knew it, never understood what an absolute candy cane walk in Disneyland my upbringing was till I went out to the real world. And my father was an international attorney who I was told recently by someone at DOD was MJ-12, which explained a hell of a lot about what went on in my youth in our home. And I've been a researcher all my life. I've written 24 screenplays, been thrown out of Hollywood twice, pretty much blackballed there. As soon as I get some various projects done, one of which you saw my filthy hands and my filthy coveralls, I'm installing a fifth wheel hitch in my crew cab pickup right now, and let me tell you, drilling through the frame on a Sunday afternoon is not really my idea of a good time. Basically, I'm a child of the 60s. I researched. I had some tremendous, tremendous mentors, and I have done an extraordinary number of different things for a living. I've made it my business to do that. Currently, I'm driving concrete mixers and occasionally heavy equipment for a civil engineering firm on San Juan Island in Washington State. in the San Juans, the only county that is all islands in the United States of America. And what is going on now in our world calls upon, I think, all of us to stand for a moment, give an opinion, say, gee, maybe we should look this way. And my comment when you and I believe it was Simon were talking about the pyramid and the ejection of water, I recalled the Conco pump story, which I came across on the Internet, I think, in the early 90s. It was a long time ago. I like to say when the Internet was still young. And the gentleman had written a book about it, and he talked about enormous volumes of water being shot out in seconds, and it was done by burning a small piece of papyrus paper. And he claimed that the pyramid was, in fact, a pumping device. Also extrapolated from that claim that the pyramids must have been built there for floating the huge stone blocks and putting them in place via a rising wall that would contain water and then just raise the water level as you go and float all your blocks in place. That sounds cool, but I'm a guy that works in concrete and heavy equipment, and you got to get the blocks to the water. So I never really went with that part of it. And then when you mentioned that the water is fired out of the pyramid into a plasma, I went, no, wait a minute. That makes more sense.
Excellent. Excellent. So can I just jump in before you, before you go into like, you know, telling me about, so cause, I'm interested in, you know, where you've been. What you're talking about is essentially you're a child of the military industrial complex. And your father was CIA, so you'll have some hidden memories, won't you?
Well,
have you found yourself thinking, what was I doing in 75? Do you happen to have had any recall of being on some weird summer school activities, for instance, if you understand what I'm saying?
I seem to have more than one set of memories. There is a possibility, and I don't really want to make this about me, but I suppose people would like to know something about me. There is a possibility that I was one of the kids that at a very young age was introduced into what was then called a secret military program. Apparently those who were MJ-12 used their own kids because they could not justify putting other people's kids.
Exactly. They were all assets.
So you kind of got volunteered. Now, if you listen to folks like Randy Kramer and Corey Good and even Dave Wilcock, who doesn't claim himself personally to have been through it, you know, if someone has control of the ability to eliminate memories, and then there is a process within a human being that as they age, things that have been tucked away by electronical magic seem to find their way out into your consciousness. But, alas, the thing is, it's hard to prove. If you have memories of having been, say, a POW on the moon for an extended period of time, you could write an entire screenplay about it, which I did. But there's no way I can say, oh, let's go out to the moon and I'll prove it. I'll show you where everything is that I said. So any recovered memory that I may have dealt with or that I have filed away, that I'm perhaps building file cabinets of memories and trying to tie them together temporally, that's probably something that I'll deal with for a long time. And at 61, a long time to me isn't what it used to be. So I don't know if there'll ever be really any clarity where I can make statements like Randy Kramer does. But the first time I listened to Dave Corso, and there were a couple of other of the early guys there, I got very, very uncomfortable, and I had to leave the place. And I actually went camping for a few days up in the mountains, and I really had a lot going on. So I had a lot of respect for Dave. There was something about Dave in particular that I really resonated with. And so, you know, did somebody put me in a program and then erase my memory? Maybe. I don't know. If by definition, an erased memory is something that's
It's not there anymore, yeah, and you won't remember it, yeah.
So, do I have lots of very vivid, weird dreams about things that no one else seems to dream about? Oh, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Do I sometimes wake up with scars that I didn't have the day before that are healed on my body? Yeah. Has it been witnessed? Yeah. And then those scars will disappear on their own.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes I'll wake up with injuries that I don't really remember dislocating my shoulder. But gee, that's what it feels like I did. I'm dealing with that one now. And I guess maybe I just fall out of bed and put myself back to bed while I'm still asleep.
Glenn,
these are very familiar stories because I've met other people like you, or at least I've spoken to them on my show and in private, and there's a lot of stuff. How about when you watch, say, for instance, American Dad or Family Guy? Can you watch those things?
I quit watching television many years ago because I started in television.
Mm.
And,
it's like knowing what sausages are made of.
Exactly, very much so. I mean, I've read all the patents, RAND Corporation, Siemens, Brain Frequency Entrainment with the NTSC, the National Television Signal Code.
Mm.
I was a first class FCC engineer for television when I was 18.
Right, and so you know all about subliminal encoding and modulation and encoding.
Right.
I'll just explain what I did. Modulation is the process by which you can take a plane signal and impose a second signal. Say, your plane signal is a single frequency. And then you impose, your voice onto it, make that signal vary that. Then you can send that across an electronic wave like a radio. The thing is that when you have a conversation, for instance, the conversation that Glenn and I are having right now, encoded onto my voice is stuff that my higher self is feeding down into the third dimension through me, through this conversation, resonating off Glenn and then bouncing off into the audience for everybody else's resonance, because we're all like, we all have a very empathic feeling with each other. There's a very strong feeling of oneness and family with us. So, so there's a lot of support and a lot of love, that works with our broadcast, and it's a very beautiful thing. Having said that, you were talking earlier about, when you were growing up, you had,
I had the good fortune of growing up without much concern about where my next meal was going to come from. My dad, who took enormous strides in his own life. I mean, that guy started out barefoot in a dirt floor sharecropper shack, in North Dakota. And, in 1983, he was on Ed Meese's commission to China and involved in a number of things. My dad knew, Peter Beter. I can remember Peter Beter calling the house and asking for my dad numerous times when I was a young kid.
Have you read Sands of Time?
I have not.
Oh my God, I think you should.
Perhaps I should. My book reading has been put off by my transplantation to the island, during which time I have to get a piece of land, build a house, blah, blah, blah. So I'm really busy this summer.
Okay, maybe an audio book while you're building.
Well, yeah, you know, actually, I have yet to get into those, and I've actually recorded one, so it's funny, I haven't done it myself.
Yeah. Well, you know, I've got an audio book that I did of Die Glocke, so it's a very deep book that if you want to find out about the Nazi program of building the bell. But anyway...
If you read Schauberger, I mean, you pretty much got it.
Yeah, exactly. And so this brings us neatly to the subject of vortex mechanics. And how the hell do all of these data points add up? All right, so I've got a few data points that I'd like to lay out for you as an engineer. You understand, you'll understand the kind of the terms that I'm talking about. And that these are things that can be definitely looked up, historically and all of this. So, let's start. Now, number one, have you had experience with something called gunite or a machine called a gunite blower?
Much, yes. That's how we built swimming pools in America, at least the better ones.
Okay, so now, I have a friend, my best friend. I see him every week sometimes. He is a lime plaster expert and obsessive. You know, he talks about it all the time. He's a gunite machine. So several years ago, we had a conversation and, he was telling me that if you took limestone and, heated up and burned it in a particular way, it becomes lime, and you can make a mortar by adding water, and then you can, you know, pump it and spray it, and, you know, there you go. And I thought, that's interesting. So I said to him, would it be therefore possible that you could pump up a kind of concrete mix, even in a sort of prehistoric time, and make a kind of, you know, you have a board and you make the form, and then you lay one block next to the other. And that would account for the idea that there would be, that there are no gaps between all these blocks. And I was saying, oh, that's interesting.
I agree with you completely.
And then,
it was a mix and they poured them.
And here's the thing. And he said, yeah, so if that were true, then if you took a core, sample of this, if you drilled a kind of long drill that, created a stick of right, all the different strata of this, and you analyzed it, you will find that the shells, the fossils, will sink to the bottom. Won't you? If you've got this mixture that has a sort of certain quantity of shells, that they would, if it was all liquid, then it would eventually work out that they were sediment.
You raise an interesting point, because in concrete, and I'll go briefly through how concrete actually works.
Mm-hmm.
Concrete cures by a process called hydration. And hydration is simply that when that limestone is cooked, there are limestone kilns here on the west end of San Juan Island, where that for many years they made cement, limestone cement and lime to do plastering. You take limestone, crush it into a powder, you cook it till it's extraordinarily dry, then you reconstitute it with an aggregate, sand and certain size rock, and water. And what will happen is that as the water comes in and wraps itself into those little particles of lime again, they suck it up and they swell ever so slightly. And in so doing, they bind together. But now, instead of having basically soft limestone, you have a limestone matrix that is now impregnated with sand at very, very close proximity, and also gravels of different sizes. Therefore, the overall inherent compressive strength is much greater than the limestone. And so when you are going to make a block for a pyramid, I've not been to the pyramids. I've never looked at the rock, but there is really no reason in my mind, especially what I've envisioned with the idea of spraying pumice for structures, that if you have whatever kind of stone, if you can put it into a matrix in which you can then stabilize it, cure it, if you will, it could look like natural stone. Very easily. And I remember reading, this has been some time, I've been trying to find the book again, but I've not been able to. There was a book written called Hunati. I've been chasing this book since the early 70s. And it was about a fellow who worked in the Harvard Force in, Asia, Southern Asia. And, he discovered a tribe that knew of a vine. The sap from that vine would, when applied to granite rock or any kind of rock, would reduce it to the consistency of cheese for a period of time, and then it would recure as the original rock. And
hang on a second. So let's just pause to say that in nature exists, therefore, material that can change rock into something much softer.
Correct.
So this is a chemical means, right?
Right. And I do not know of anyone that I've talked to about it who could whip up out of their head and their chemistry educational course. If you did that, and you found that vine, it would melt rock. I only read it in a book whose name I remember because I really would like to write the screenplay for that book, that there was this event where he came through the forest and came across people that were adding, what they were doing was making stoneware. They were making stone bowls and stone cups, and they were using this substance to soften the rock so they could shape it like clay. And then it was rock when it dried.
Awesome. I want
Well, it would make sense that there would be something on the planet that could do that because it would be such a handy thing.
Exactly. It would be very, very handy. So here's the thing. I believe that the pyramids were poured into place by using Archimedean pumps with imported lime that came from various places around. There are lime kilns all over the area. And that's probably why there aren't any trees left, because they had to burn all the trees in order to create the lime to move to the pyramids to make the pyramid. thus deforesting the entire area and rendering it wasteland.
Never doubt the wealth of pharaohs. I mean, you know, when you can mobilize 10,000 people and somehow get them fed and watered and get X number of hours of work out of them a day, if you are a project engineer and you know how to make use of 10,000 sets of human muscles, you can get one hell of a lot of work done. No question about it. But you have to have the engineering approach that you're going to make use of all that muscle. And that in itself is a whole flow chart of activities and materials that all come together like a weave and end up much like when I batch concrete for a load I'm going to haul out of this plant. We all the drivers batch their own. I'm bringing together the aggregate, which is sand and rock going up a conveyor belt. I'm bringing powdered cement, Portland cement, down from a tank above using fluffing airbags and some air pressure. And then I'm running water in, and I bring all of this together in the truck at one time, and I can use additives to entrain air in the concrete to delay its curing. There's all sorts of chemistry around it, but basically you put it all together and then you have a raw material. If they were going to pour the pyramids, we are standing here on a denuded plain with these large megaliths staring at us, but we have no idea what kind of heavy equipment did they have? What kind of team? I mean, what could you do to accomplish that where you would use large teams of people doing individual tasks? I'm sure that architectural colleges and other brilliant people have sat down and tried to figure it all out.
Mm-hmm.
But the remarkable thing is that somebody that period of time ago made basically simple work out of it, gave everybody a bunch of rice and chits and, you know, and fed an army and did it. So I would say the civil engineers, those guys are in a league of their own. And would I like to see their playbook? Oh, yeah. You bet I would.
Well, you know, one of the things that, having read the Die Glocke, project, book, I realized that, I'm sorry?
Send me the book.
Well, you can go to my website and download it.
Oh, okay.
I read it out. Because I want, you know, it was a little rare book, I thought, bloody hell, everybody's got to hear this. not everybody wants to hear it, but it's brilliant and you'd love it. But one thing I realized is exactly as you said, that kind of organization requires, you know, literally superhuman organization. That's probably what, you know, they were trying to be giants. You know, it was a giant project. They called it Project Risa, which means giant. And you know, what you said before, you know, you would need a giant team of people, to do these very large things. How about a team of giants?
Well, I say, what was their heavy equipment? Well, if I've got a giant, you know, I mean, the records show that people were, you know, up to 30 feet and more, at various times on the planet. Now you got an extra row of teeth and a sixth finger for that stunt, but, I think I can put up with that for being 36 feet, providing you can find the groceries. So, you know, that could be an ace in the hole, what we would call a uni-ratchet in a machine shop. You know, it's the tool that you go to simply because it does it every time. Hey, Igor, go pick up that gigantic boulder over there and whittle off four equal sides for me, will you? You know, I mean, who knows what they were able to do? One of the great mentors I've had in my life is a lady who published Perception magazines. And I won't, her first name's Gwen, but I won't give her last name because she's kind of picky about that. But she used to talk about the fact that trying to figure out reality on this planet is like waking up after a three-day drunk inside the last beer can you emptied and having no other view of the world except that opening shaped like a beer tab that you're looking out of because you're too big to get out of the can. And now you're supposed to tell everybody how the world works. Looking back in history is a lot like that. You are simply in that beer can looking through that tab, and you can't see 90%, 99% of what was there because it's gone. Peter Beter called it forensic circumstantial evidentiary crime scene discovery. Believe it or not, I actually remember that.
Wow. So, seen from inside the beer can. Here we are. We are inside the beer can, but it does take a godlike perception to look down and make sense of the whole thing. You know.
Oh my heavens.
Because people say, how could, for instance, how could a benevolent God allow this to happen? Really? So God's benevolent, is he? All right. Well, that's the God that you want. Not everyone.
Well, if you read the Secret Treaty of Verona, 1522, in which they agreed to pay France 20 million gold guilders a year to go crush the populist movement in Spain, they say right in that treaty, Secret Treaty of Verona, everybody, it was entered into the congressional record in the United States of America, I believe in 1990, and it was done so because they said, shit, everybody should know this. And what the crown princes said is that, among other things, that the priest class should be given whatever they deem necessary to maintain their control of the masses, as we have learned that the crown princes of Europe have learned that religion is the best means of controlling the masses. So religion, of course, is garbage. Spirituality is great truth. And you have to walk somewhere between the dogma of the arithmetic you were taught, let's call that religion, and the idea that, hey, maybe somebody had something that could melt stone, which is the spiritual, or the what if, or why not.
Or the out of the box.
The out of the box. So that's a very good way to tag it. So we're all kind of walking through this wonderful little mystery, and basically where we are at on the planet, as I see it now, is we are in a tough spot, because we either have to go kill a bunch of very crazy people who are extraordinarily violent, always have been, have no regard for human life, and or we must find another way for everybody to walk another direction. And I actually have a bit of an idea about that, related to the Brexit thing, which is both, I'm quite sure, monitored, controlled, and managed. When you see the dark side send somebody out to murder an innocent woman and scream platitudes that position you to be a knifing crazy man if you vote to leave something that's evil, and or, you know, you're not going to obey the masters anymore. In the moment that we are in, where we are looking at a greater reality, you know what Dave Wilcock and Corey Good and Randy Kramer and a bunch of others are talking about. We know what Dave Corso had to say. We know that those days of plucking us from the fields of laboring humans and using us for the most distorted and evil things, unaccountable, without any, you're unimpeachable, you can do what you want to anyone you want, and nobody raises a finger, those days are gone. And now you're worried about pitchforks. You're not worried about pitchforks. You're worried about people coming and putting a 45 between your eyes because you're evil and you killed a lot of people. So what do you do to stay out of that position? Well, you could have me come to England for a little chat with the Queen regarding the Dutchman. Now, I know they listen to your show, JP, and I see a way for Britain to emerge as a tremendous leader, and the Queen knows of what I speak, and I would speak with her about it. Passage for two, bring me to the Queen, and I will speak to her about an advantage that I don't think anyone in England, especially in the power structure, sees is wide open and available to them. And it would allow Britain to take the lead, and we could go probably in a better direction. But it takes people who've been watching, like myself, like yourself, like Simon. My God, you know what? Don't we all wish we could just elect a Simon? Simon, you run the world until you screw up. Here, good. Good on you. Thank you for being as brilliant and calm and evenly spoken as you are, and with all those little information things you have. All right, can we please just take the vote? Simon's in charge until further notice. All eyes, eyes have it. Okay.
Do you know what? What I'd prefer is that we all behave like Simon. That's what I prefer.
Wouldn't that be awesome?
That would be even better, wouldn't it? That we don't need anybody to be in charge.
Right.
Because we all carry an equal amount of charge. Because it's all electric in the end, isn't it?
Well, and very true. That's,
and anyway, let's you know, we could go down lots of rabbit holes tonight, and perhaps we could explore some other rabbit holes further on down the road.
Sure, let's go.
And you know, as well as like round tables and things like that. But here's the thing, you know, let's focus back all those. Right. So maybe, you know, when the pyramid was built, it wasn't. Oh, a desert. It might have been green. There might have been lots of forests and plenty of renewable wood, plenty of cedar to burn this limestone and to do the big bit. So here's the thing. We have found several data points. Now, number one. So many things. Where to start. Right, number one, pyramids are built near water supplies. Almost every pyramid that has been found seems to have what they call, quote, flooded tunnels, unquote. Okay, so let's place that as data point number one, shall we? Now, I would like to then further say the capstone of the pyramid is a different material from the rest of the stone. And that because of the charge potential between the ground and something high up in the air can generate quite a number of volts. Say, you know, a few thousand, enough to get, that's what Wardenclyffe Tower was. You know, if you imagine that Tesla built Wardenclyffe Tower, the tower itself is simply to get that ball in the sky. So let's say that the pyramid itself was a thing to get a great big ball in the sky. And the fact that it's like, you know, 51 degrees, that's just like completely by the by. That's just what it's like. You know, that's the quality of the grain of quartz. You know, it's just like that. It's just a factor of its fractality. But the main thing is to get the big ball in the sky in order to create an electrical potential. Okay, so that's a theoretical data point, right? Because we don't know for certain what was on top of the pyramid, but we do know for certain that there was something there that is different from the thing, because it's not like lopped off. It's like the thing stops, doesn't it?
Or perhaps the thing that was above it could have been held by some sort of vortex or torsional field, and when the generation of that field stopped, it simply rolled away.
Mm-hmm.
Down one side and away. And I mean,
like a ping pong ball on a fountain.
Well, very much. And the the idea that these pyramids were designed to shoot enormous amounts of water, basically on command, and that we know of the piezo electric effect of quartz. If one were to envision a quartz four-sided pyramidal stone as the cap stone, the energy patterns that would be set up in that pyramid of quartz, and then be impinged on by the piezoelectric, if you will, of a piece of quartz sitting up on that height and exposed to the air. Now, you're saying perhaps even a ball of some sort above that because of the resonance created by the ball. Am I correct?
What I'm putting forward is potentially... Now, here's the thing. Like, I've only discovered this material a couple of years ago, right? It's a form of graphite called shungite. And our station is all about shungite. We're all over it, right? And I've got lots of it here. I showed you a pyramid made of it earlier. Do you know what it is? I sound like Morpheus. Do you know what it is?
I do not.
Right. Well, this is going to maybe... This adds grist to the mill, right? It comes from Russia, near a river called Shunga, which is why it's called shungite. And there's one deposit of this stuff on the planet there. And it's a mineral, but it's carbon, in the fullerene form.
Okay.
And it conducts electricity.
Sure.
So you got this piece of rock, you know, and I love freaking my friends out because I've got all these different rocks. I've got lapis lazuli here. I've got obsidian. I've got quartz and I've got shungite. And I say, okay, guys, so here's my electric meter here. Try it on the lapis. Here, try it on the quartz. Here's on the obsidian. Try it on this. What do you think? It's not going to conduct and beep. You know, there it goes. It conducts electricity. And every piece of shungite conducts electricity. Like metal, but it feels like a kind of it almost feels like plastic, but it's got a very low resistance. So there's a kind of, I'm wondering if there is not the idea that there could be a big shungite sphere or some other conducting material at the top of the pyramid right now. Okay. So, we've kind of come to the idea, all right, so the idea of it is to get this big thing up in the sky. So you have to build a structure that's big enough to support it. And that's what, you know, this is going to last a long time. Otherwise, you're going to just, you know, you may have a column, you know, you can start off with a column.
Sure.
That just, you know, starts and then it goes all the way up and has the great big thing on the top. But that's not going to last 1,000 years. But if you got a big piece of rock that's, or a big bunch of stuff that is going to stay as, you know, is in the most stable possible formation to start with, you know,
right.
A pyramid just is exactly like a pile of sand. It'll just stay there. Right. So that's why it's like the most stable solid. So here we go. So we've already, you know, the fact that it's just kind of filled in with like, liquid polymer. You know, liquid geopolymer that hardens right. to what we think is called a limestone.
Right.
That's almost by the by. The idea is what it is, the device that it is. Okay. So let's take some more data points. Now, there's the idea of the great, the King's Chamber. All right, so let's go to this place. Now, I've never been there, but, you know, everybody has seen that little map of the inside of the pyramid, and you see the Queen's Chamber right on the ground level, and then there's a King's Chamber in this position. And as Walt and Nancy were talking about, well, you know, it is a... And as I've been going on for thousands, what feels like thousands of years, I probably have, that it's... It's a harmonic position. It's exactly one third. It's a geometric form. It's like the harmonic on a guitar string. There's all sorts of meaning as to why that place is there. And so if you were to create a vortex, if you were to create a small vortex at that position, the position of it would amplify it. It's like the right place to take the bow, onto a cello string, you know. that there's a really appropriate place where you can have the maximum sound for the minimum effort. So, all right, so we've got a big pile of things. We've got the thing in one third of the way along. Right. Now, here's where it starts getting interesting, because there's this room, right, which they call the King's Chamber. And this room has a very strange entrance. You've heard of this entrance, haven't you?
Yes.
Where you have to kind of bend right double over in order to get underneath and get in there.
It's an expansion chamber after that passage, yeah.
Okay, so here's the thing. What I don't know, and it's very possible, but is the top of the sarcophagus level or higher than that entranceway?
Well, I do not know. I was studying the pyramids intensely when I was a younger man, and never got there to make the visit. And I have just let pyramids and all the books that I still have kind of go by the wayside while other things, you know, came along.
All right. So, okay. So here's, I just want to continue this thread. Okay. So here's the thing. All right. There's this thing that they call the Ark of the Covenant.
Right.
I believe that the Ark of the Covenant was the device that sat inside that stone sarcophagus. It wasn't a sarcophagus at all. It was a container for an anti-gravity fusion device, which is what we call the Ark of the Covenant.
That would make sense, yeah.
Okay. Inside the Ark of the Covenant is basically it's a charge collector made of gold. You know, it's a large, you know, it's the lining of the box, and the outer lining of the box become a huge capacitor.
Right.
And that by using sound, and the room was also built to kind of harmonize at that frequency, to amplify it, but I believe that the frequency is 108 cycles a second. You know, and that the scarabs beat their wings at that frequency. So they would have the scarab sing, and then they would sing that note, and that would be the note that activated the crystal device inside the Ark of the Covenant, which is it's like a piezo lighter. You know, your cigarette lighter that, you know, you have
with a gold capacitor, which is extremely low resistance, and that capacitor is of enormous size and therefore capacitance.
Great big charge buildup, right?
Oh, man, yeah.
Okay, so now then you have what is between the two angels that are supposed to be, the wings of the angels are essentially big electrodes.
Right.
And probably, you know, if you, you know, really, what is it, what they call seraphim and cherubim?
Yeah, I think you're right.
One would mean anode and one would mean cathode.
Oh, sure. Sure. Right.
So you get me. I mean, this is all electric.
Okay. Right.
So, your monks are humming, and maybe it takes a couple of days to get this thing running. You know, building up, and there's humming away, and eventually there's enough charge in the capacitor for the arc to literally jump from wing to wing.
Right.
And that would create a very, very large, bright, I mean, I think it's probably about 3 inches long, at least, this arc. It's going to be large. And probably they had some mechanism for drawing the angels away from each other. They may have some sort of windy thing that sort of makes the arc bigger. This reminds
right.
me. This reminds me of the Kohler device, by the way. This is all coming back now. Anyway, I'm making this up about as I'm going along, you see, because we're all tapping into the plan of it. Okay, so this thing is you're humming away, and the charge is building up, and suddenly, crack. A spark will jump from one electrode to the other. And, now, when, let's jump to the 1930s and 1940s, when, they were welding enormous ships. Now this is a data point that comes from, David Wilcock's book. When was it? The Divine, Three, massive book, massive book. I can't remember the, it's one of these. Yeah, it's the largest one. I got the audio book. Anyhow, but the point is that when they were making enormous, battleships in the 1930s and 40s, that, they were using very, very high currents. To make the arc welding devices to weld these enormous steel plates, and they would sometimes occasionally find tools missing, and they would blame each other, and you know, eventually they discovered that what was happening was that the amount of current that they were using was enough to create an arc which created a tiny little black hole, and the tools were going down into the black hole.
I'll be damned.
Yeah.
That sounds something like how they stumbled their way to Montauk.
Yeah.
I've read quite a bit about that and followed quite a bit of press in the NLD, like, because I think anybody who has any questions about their life, you got to go there and you got to take a look and say, huh, was that me or not, you know?
Mm.
But I think that the idea that if you can create that discharge, and at that same moment, you can eject a great deal of water, and you are looking for a plasmatic response.
All right. Well, hang on. Let's not jump the gun here.
All right.
Let's just leave the data point here. Is okay. That an arc can create a black hole?
Okay.
And that we have just discovered through the rebuilding of the King's Chamber that it was actually an arc room.
And I thought if you arc weld and get your mask on or off a second too late or too early,
you get burned, don't you?
Well, you see little black holes in your vision.
Yeah, because it's that's a different kind of black hole. That's a retinal burnout.
Yeah.
But here's the thing, right? So, coming back to the high priest has to wear protective gear.
Right.
Has to see through crystals.
Sure.
Right? He has to see through crystals because the light is too bright. So, he, you know, these are like a lens, crystal lenses. Well,
smoky okay. quartz or whatever.
Yeah. And then we're also talking like he's got a chest plate and he's got crystals there to protect him from the, you know, he's basically being protected from sunburn.
Sure.
Okay.
Sure.
So more data points, right? So remember before we had to crawl to get into the King's Chamber.
Right.
If you stand now, therefore, outside of the King's Chamber, or outside of that corridor, you will see a bright light coming out from underneath there, but you won't be blinded by it. And I believe that's why that great big concrete block was there. That great big stone block is there.
To block the light at chest and eyeball height, you mean?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. That would make sense.
So you can stand around comfortably outside and maybe have a fag or something. Sorry, have a cigarette.
Yeah.
Or a month, you know, a monastic smoke or whatever they do outside the King's Chamber. You know, whether they're monks or not, they might be engineers. You know, it's very likely these guys are engineers. Right?
So, well, engineers and electricians, and they are, you know, like you... the Treaty of Verona says so much to me between the lines... because people need to understand the disregard in which we're held. I think you really need to get that once. And so these guys would want to, you know, stand outside, be sure that light didn't come across their toes and their sandals. I mean, you're right, they'd want a guided path, and they probably would have tested that with some guy burning the water. You know, I mean.
All right. So, all right. We got more. Yeah. Please. I have more. So many. I've got a great big basket. All right. So let's go to the water thing. Ever since the 1970s, people have been playing with pyramids, haven't they?
They've been
sharpening their razor blades. And even Wilkinson, or is it Gillette, one of them, actually sold they gave away a free cardboard pyramid once. They realized that sales dropped after that, so they stopped with the pyramid thing, and quietly hushed it up. But
you know, it's gone down into urban folklore that you can sharpen a razor blade with a little cardboard pyramid. Yeah.
And there actually were, my dad had one. He got a lot of interesting things.
Yeah, being a member of the military-industrial complex gives you its advantages.
Well, but I remember a little gold set. They were gold anodized, probably aluminum pyramids that were in a card, 3x5. And the pyramids were all about 3/4 of an inch square. He did for quite a while. It was just about when I started shaving, which is why I paid attention to it. We were still all using double-edge safety razors. And I remember him having this thing, and I said, well, what's that? And he said, well, it's supposed to sharpen razor blades. I got it down at the Naval Postgraduate School. Mm-hmm. Now, my father, being an attorney, does not describe a scenario where he'll just drop by the Naval Postgraduate School in Monterey, where they do a lot of very, very high, and pick up a pyramid razor sharpener. He was in there quite a bit, and I was in there quite a bit. Mm-hmm. Because I was very precocious, and I was going to court with my dad by the time I was 7 years old. And, so, you know, I was the shoo-in to bolt up at Stanford, you know, full ride scholarship. And by then, the level of crime in this country had percolated down into the legal system to where my dad and I had a long discussion, and he didn't think it was worth it. And so a writer I became, and I've done a lot of interesting things since then. But the idea that you could have all of this technology held in the hands of a very few people, keeping the populace ignorant, calling it magic or God or religion, and then we stand there now, we look at a desert where all that's left is the big power transmitter or the controller of the water via those passages. But it was the base piece of equipment. And as you've said, we're missing all the little wires and levers and sorts of pieces that would have also been required.
Okay, yes. Go ahead.
Do go on with your, I want to hear us get to a plasma shot.
All right. So, you know, we're gathering data points. We have to gather the data points first because we've got a foundation. So pyramids. Let's say, as a generalization, can have an effect even on the most solid appearing matter as like a steel razor. Yeah?
Sure.
Okay, so the other thing that people have found when they put things into pyramids is the effect of mummification or, shall we say, dehydration.
Yes.
Now, this should be a clue. Now,
yeah, it should actually.
Shouldn't it? Because what's happening to the water? What's happening to the water that is inside the pyramid is it's disappearing. Isn't it?
And if you dry, for instance, I have, still in my plans, pyramid dried fruit, which is something I'm going to do on a piece of property here in the islands. Mm-hmm. And I've been planning it for years, and that is to simply set up pyramids for the purpose of preserving food, nothing else.
So, Glenn, pyramids destroy water?
Well, but the thing is that when you dry a cherry in a pyramid, it tastes like a fresh cherry. That's it does not taste like a dried cherry.
That's right. Because what it does is, instead of allowing the thing to collapse, the water just leaves the place. It just leaves the plant. It leaves the organic material. Where does the water go, Glenn?
Well, now I'm seeing a plasma reaction coming on.
Yeah, you can feel a plasma reaction coming on. All right, so let's collect some more data. You know, we're building up a nice series of like, oh, that's an interesting data point, and that's an interesting. And I just want to lay them all out because I've dug these for years, these little nuggets. Okay, so more data points. When you put something in, all right, so the other, another great anomaly about the pyramid is these
these amazing shafts that point to Sirius, or they point to Alpha Centauri, or they point up my bum. No, but basically, sorry, people ascribe a lot of significance to these things, saying that there are the at this point they are in alignment with that point. And I really don't believe that, because I believe that the Earth has been tossed around like a beach ball, and it really has no connection with the star map of 3,500 years ago, let alone 50,000 years ago. It has no connection at all with what things are pointing to today as to what things were pointing to when that thing was built. Right, now, I have another purpose, and a very, very, very significant purpose for these shafts. What do you think that might be, Glenn?
Well, I would have to say some sort of temporal slash navigational fix.
No, come on, Mr. Engineer. Listen, all right, so here's some more data points. It has been discovered that there used to be gold in the form of cabling that was wrapped around the outside of the pyramid, and which is why they ripped off the stones to get at the gold underneath.
Oh, that would make sense.
Okay.
Sure.
So the gold was cabling. The gold was the antenna. And there were two shafts because there was a positive and a negative one. Again, we got anodes and cathodes. You know,
right.
Cherubim and succubim, or cherubim and seraphim, and that these shafts. Now, if you look at these shafts, everybody's, oh, you know, they send a little robot up there, and you know, they see this little thing. You know, Kilroy was here, you know, 2000 BC, and then they come across this little door. Oh, this, you know, right across the shaft is this thing, and on it, when I looked at these things, I thought, oh, those are electrical fittings. You know, anybody who's even like built a house, you know, involved in construction, has a basic idea of what they're looking at when they're looking at that thing. It's an electrical connection. What's it for? It's for the phased array that is the outside skin of the pyramid has a crisscross phased array. There's one that goes up, one goes down. One goes clockwise, one goes anticlockwise. And by varying the phase angle, you can steer the water that has been dehydrated out of the center, and you can cause it to rain in different places by steering it. How about that?
Well, I communicate with Gordon Duff at Veterans Today fairly often, and he talks about making it rain on Colonel Jim Hankey's house for 7 days straight with their little, I don't know whether it was CIA or DARPA weather control machine that they got. And it's certainly possible to create anomalous things like that in specific locations if you have the proper grid set up to cause the reaction to happen. I mean, the idea that was the first I'd ever heard about gold cabling around the pyramid creating a circuit, but it makes perfect sense because that's a hell of a lot of work to build something that, with the addition of a few missing pieces we've all wondered about, would do something with tremendous effect. I mean, so that much mass engineered into something that produces results would imply, just by its mass, that it would be a pretty damn big result.
Well, exactly, you see. So now, you're getting the idea. So we've got, like, a current generator, Wardenclyffe style. You know, there's the globe up there, right? So you've got the globe on top. You got this great big spiraling down and spiraling back up again, and joining together in the machine room in the king's chamber, where the seraphim, the seraphim and the cherubim are connected in with these. You know, there's probably cables. There's probably there was that great big light bulb thing. You know,
right.
That funny little long light bulby thing with the snake inside it.
It's probably a light bulby thing with a snake inside it. They have all these very electrical looking things. One of the other things, this is a non-pyramid related data point, but if you look at every picture of the so-called Anunnaki or these giant beings, because, you look at them and everybody say, oh no, they were pharaohs, so they made them bigger. No. As we said before, I believe they were giants. They were bigger than us. And one of the things that you will notice about them that is every one of them sits on a chair that has the same kind of ceramic, what do you call them? Oh, God.
Insulators.
Yes. Ceramic insulators stacked up three high, don't they? You ever notice that? As an engineer?
Yes, now that you bring it up, I have.
Yeah, interesting, isn't it?
You always kind of go, huh, I wonder if that's just, fancy carved knobs on their chairs.
No, because it's every one of them. And also, not only that, is that no matter where on the planet you see these carvings, they're all the same, And they all, now, here's the one thing that I haven't figured out yet. I'm just throwing this out there. I was going to say, what the heck is that Akon thing? With the handbag thing. You know what I'm saying? There's a pine cone, acorn-y thing.
The acorn thing, I think, is a pine cone.
Yeah, it looks like a pine cone. And they all have a handbag.
A pineal gland, supposedly.
I think it's a thing. It's a thing. They wouldn't just metaphorically carve something. It wouldn't take all that time because it's a metaphor. It's a thing, right. It's a thing. Like everything else is a thing, that's one of the unanswered things that I have. But, we can't know everything and we can't figure out everything and, we have to talk to everybody. So I'm just throwing it out there. There's another thing. Did we play a tune?
I don't believe we did.
No, I think we need a little bit of a break because I need to go and make another brew of coffee and actually make a decent one this time because it was disappointing.
I was planning to get another cup myself.
Yeah. Let's see if we can all... No, I did that one. Let's go and get some more music. Well, I've got loads of music.
Oh, for all the guys out there who may have gone through something that they don't have direct memories of, try Tom Petty's Saving Grace. I think he said it extremely well.
Tom Petty's Saving Grace. Well, I'll just pull that up.
30th anniversary on YouTube.
Hang on. Da, 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 da. Oh, no. I spelt it grave, but I'm sure somebody will correct it. It will correct for me. Okay, so time there we go. 3 minutes 49. That'll do. There's probably going to be an advert. Yes, there's going to be an advert, so I'll just talk over the advert until the skip ad thing comes on for me. Here we go.
There's a line in that song. It's hard to say who you are these days. Mm-hmm. Boy, oh boy, do I think about that a lot.
Tom Petty and the Heartbreakers, Saving Grace. Well, good choice. Excellent. And tonight, welcome back to Ever Beyond. Now, where are we? This is Ever Beyond. We're on Ever Beyond Radio, of course, everyoneradio.com.
Hello.
We're a listener-supported radio station, so please hit the donation button, and you can put a fixed one-time amount, or you can come along to the archives and rent the archive space for $5 a month, and you can download as much as you like. You max out your broadband for a month. We don't mind. You can take it. Fine. We really have no objections at all because, if you can only afford $5 to download as much as you can, then brilliant. If you're interested, we can send a memory stick of archives that you can buy for a fixed price, and we'll sort that out, like all of the shows of a particular show or whatever combination you'd like. The whole shows for a year back, that's about 18 gigabytes I've discovered. And yes, Suzanne, it's on your way. It's on its way to you, all the way to Australia, winging its way. Well, kind of crawling its way. It's probably swimming. Anyway, poor little thing. But I hope you'll enjoy what you get when you open it. Anyway, so we also have Wolf Spirit Radio with Hangi Shack Radio, who's the other half of Wolf Spirit. We do 3.5 days each. It's a lot of work. It really is a lot of work. And it takes a multiple personality to kind of do this, because you have to do loads of things, until you get friends. And we have some lovely friends, and, the friends become part of the team, and eventually some friends will be, radio show hosts, even though she doesn't know it yet, Vanessa. But I mean, one day there'll be radios, but, until that, she's just taking the vacation, poor love. She's squirming away in the chat room there. She looks after the forum. Please come along to the forum, go to the listen page, and you can see there's a forum at the top. Click that, and then join, and Vanessa will show you around and show you how to do things, and enjoy chatting offline with other members of the Wolf Spirit Radio family. So, welcome back. This is Ever Beyond. My guest tonight is Glenn Murphy, and we are talking data points here.
Major data points.
How's it been for you so far?
Well, I think that we're stumbling along towards something that you have an idea sketched out before, and I would point out that the pyramid power, I'm going to use that term, if it was understood and could be used today, and I bet thoroughly that someone today does understand it, and it is used, because we do have those wonderful YouTube videos of what looks like a plasma ejection going on above pyramids recently. And somebody knows how to operate those things. If that sort of technology could be made widely known,
yeah,
what steps could be taken for this race on this planet?
Here's the thing. All right, let's go back. Let's talk data points once more. Wardenclyffe was a tower that was created by Nikola Tesla. In the early part of last century, it fell into disrepair because it wasn't supported, and it was eventually taken down. But the idea was to get, basically, stick a great big globe, a metallic globe, high up in the sky, or 300, you know, a couple of 100 feet up, and the electrical potential between it and the ground is massive, that you can then. And what he would do, it created a wave, you know, but he used that potential to then generate a wave, right, that could then transmit electricity wirelessly to anywhere you wanted, including in a car. And all you'd need is an antenna of the particular length, and you'd get electricity out of it. And that's what he did, and that's how he created all these amazing phenomena. So
no wonder that it is now in disrepair and gone.
Exactly. However, let's just take that same concept and say, well, that's what the pyramid did. Pure and simple. You know?
It would be a logical conclusion.
Yeah.
And
considering now we've got a circuit of what's going on inside and outside it.
Well, we know the Egyptians had electrical batteries. I believe they used vinegar as an electrolyte, as I recall.
Probably snake urine or something. You know?
Well. The point is that if mankind was suddenly placed here and he was sitting under a bush on his first day and saw lightning in the distance, mankind being what he is going to start getting ideas even while he's rubbing sticks together to start his fire. He's going to be thinking about how nice it would be if he could control that and just start a fire whenever he wanted. So I have no doubt that in the course of a human lifespan long ago, questions were put together in the correct order, and they resulted in answers that accumulated in the correct plan, and someone basically created this energy system, and that is lost to us now may not be any, the lost part may not be any further away from us than the Vatican Library, where so many things were rushed off in the name of God that the little people couldn't know about. And
I think it's possible to reconstruct this thing and then
I agree
miniaturize it.
Well, why not proceed with your plan and build a model from it and then open source that model. And I'll bet you in very quick order, people will be adding pieces. There is, however, something that I've yet to try, but I have worked it out on paper with the circuit and see no reason it wouldn't work. And it was put on YouTube by a fella who looks very Russian to me, very black Russian. And the name of the YouTube video is called Tesla's Little Secret. And what he did was postulate that you could lay wire in the ground, just insulated wire in the ground. And then you could set up a diode and a capacitor and a spark gap, and you could get about 50 volts per foot out of that wire, and it would be alternating current. And I would urge anybody that's electronically inclined to go watch Tesla's Little Secret on YouTube.
I have indeed. I have a show on Thursdays called Full Spectrum Science. It's an occasional show because I'm, you know, Thursday. It's like it's kind of hard to keep doing radio all evening. I do need a break, and sometimes I need a break.
For many years, JP, on rock and roll. I know what you.
But the. So that might be an interesting little approach to do a show about that. You know, just like the open sourcing of the Tesla secret. So if we now apply, can you apply that to the design and the construction of the pyramid?
Well, of course, what they would be doing would be taking the circuit that this fellow who I believe his name is Max, described as going into the ground, or Matt, perhaps, going into the ground, if you had a lattice of, shall we say, opposite spirals of gold laid into a pyramidal structure, you've basically just taken the wire out of the ground and put it on something that has shape, which is probably going to have an aiming effect of whatever it creates as far as a wave or particle ejection or an electronic discharge.
Exactly.
Would be my thought.
It's and phased array, like HARP, can be steered. Just by changing the phase, which probably simply involved moving backwards and forwards one of these angels. You know, it's probably just, you know, one of those really that simple thing. Now, another data point is that there are legends that the pyramid was able to produce weather patterns in different parts of the land. They basically to do weather control. They could steer clouds. So basically, they could. Right now, here's where we go. This is the plasma. This is the bit. So we got our plasma arc. Right now, we've also got our water pump.
Right.
So perhaps what they did is that they set off their crystal vibration. You know, they got their monks chanting, and you know, they get the thing running.
Everything's sound, right.
Yeah. That's the kickstart, and then once they got that going, the potential that was coming in from the globe on the top of the pyramid was powering up, and the charge would build up, and then eventually the arc would start. Once the arc was running, they probably got the heck out of there.
I would think that you would want to, yeah. Playing with that kind of voltage, and it's open, basically. It can fill a room or whatever. I wouldn't want to be in the room. Mm. When I was working in television, the other time I went into the Klystron cage at the transmitter, I was wearing two large copper woven ground straps that had to be on the concrete and on me at the same time, just to be in the cage.
Mm.
And the problem from that was that you might draw an arc. And as a concrete pump operator, you've seen those big trucks with a boom that goes up in the air, and then we can reach out, over 100 feet and pump concrete to you. The number one way that pump operators die in the industry is to draw an arc from a power line.
Mm.
And you don't have to be touching it. You can be several feet away.
Yeah, so an arc can jump.
Yes.
That's one of its things.
That's why it was twice an arc. It is going somewhere.
Yeah. They are almost intelligent. And another data point is that all electricity is intelligent.
I would have to agree. I think it is a conscious. I think of electricity as kind of like asking water to come out and play. Electricity has. I've always gotten the impression electricity has fun doing what it does.
Mm, mm.
It's very, and it's interesting, and they get to be inside of all the little things that we make and partake of the intelligence, as it were, in the creation of the devices that it travels through. And it seems that in my life, that travel is a great educator. And why should it be any different for me if I go out and truck for 2 million miles all over the United States and Canada? What do I learn? And if we run electricity through all these devices and whatnot, we're saying, well, that's just dumb electricity, you can't learn.
Hmm. And who's to say that electricity isn't the first nature of things? You know, primal nature is, because everybody says, look, we're all energy, aren't we? Well, what's the what's the closest thing that we have to pure energy is electricity, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
Plasma next. Plasma comes closer to pure, pure primordial energetic form or formlessness. And
well, I found that the use of plasma in the off-the-books world, I have, for a guy who is just an ordinary guy who drives a truck, I have an extraordinary number of friends with security clearances that give ordinary people nosebleeds. And part of it is because I'm a writer. And I have, as a writer, I'm a compulsive communicator. I just seem to have this talent for meeting people. And then what I hear about, is that plasma is a very well-known, commonly used, high energetic state of matter that is used in a number of ways in clandestine off-book operations, and is quite well-known. if you are a secret project scientist working for DARPA, my guess is you have a pretty good working knowledge of how to play with plasma.
Indeed. And it's interesting that, there's this stuff. There's all these different things called plasma, aren't there? Including our bloodstream is also called plasma.
Right.
Isn't that interesting?
Right. And you could use coconut milk in World War I and II if you did not have blood plasma. Which is also interesting. But the thing that interests me about the concept is that if we could create plasma as an everyday useful technology out in the open. Now, for instance, in welding and whatnot, we have what are called plasma cutters. A plasma torch, and these are used for cutting very thick steel very quickly and neatly.
Exactly. And not only that, you can cut stone with them, can't you?
Oh, yeah. Oh,
in fact, if you wanted to build a Great Pyramid, all you would need to do is have a jet of compressed air and a plasma arc, and we know that we've already got a plasma arc.
Right.
If you could somehow transport it using cables, maybe, I don't know, or make small ones. But
perhaps
there you can use a compressed air and a plasma arc, and you can cut stone as if it was cheese.
Right.
So there's another way of manipulating stone.
Well, we know that hydrogen, the fellow that invented the hydrogen torch, that hydrogen itself, when it burns, has unique characteristics in that you can put your finger in the flame and it won't burn you. But put it to a solid material, a more solid than your finger, a more dense material, and it will cut right through it, stone, brick, anything you want.
I want to build one of these things. This is a brown gas generator, which is...
HHO Brown's gas,
yeah.
Right, and they clean it up quite a bit. I've been following the whole HHO thing for many years quite well, and I've built a couple of systems for cars. And as a matter of fact, I'm going to be refitting a boat here with diesel engines, and I plan on running them on hydrogen. There is a fellow on YouTube. They run a brand new Chevrolet truck. I think it was a 2005 when I first saw it. They run a pressure vessel, which is a spray tank, a 60-gallon spray tank, for agriculture, and they pressurize that to 60 PSI, and that becomes their draw, for the various throttle positions as they drive this truck. They do in the video, again on YouTube, it's simple to find. They show you no gas in the tank, tank says empty. Before they pressurize the plasma tank, the truck won't start. Once the plasma tank is pressurized, they're using large dry cells. They can drive the truck, and the remarkable thing is that its performance is as good as a pair of, dual quads and a high-rise manifold and a set of headers is the difference. And it runs cool. It never gets hot, produces nothing but water at the tailpipe, and of course there's no gas involved. And they have offered that technology. They said people had a bad habit of dying when they brought this information out. Stan Meyer with his dune buggy that ran on water being a perfect example. So they put their stuff out there public, and I've just not yet had the time to build their system. But running internal combustion engines on hydrogen has a number of advantages, not the least of which being if you can get your dry cell or whatever approach you take to produce enough of the HHO gas, you could, there's a fellow who claims that in World War II, and I forget the engine number, the P-51 Mustang had an engine version that they ran on water, which would have been HHO. And
here's the thing.
Yeah.
You have a capacitor bank.
Right.
I've been experimenting with capacitor banks recently, and you know, again, you probably have too. I bought a bunch of super capacitors, so I've got a 100 farad bank, even 300 farad at 13.5 volts. So it's a nice big, you know, it's like square, 4 inches square, 6 inches square, so. This thing can be charged instantly with a big blat of lightning. Right?
Oh, sure.
And then you can start a car with a capacitor bank like that. You can start a motor. And once the motor is running, you can recharge it.
Sure.
So imagine a vehicle that just starts with one big spark. You know, you've got your home generator, it builds up a great big spark, you're in your garage, you want to go to work, you press the button, a great big spark jumps right across, charges up the car starts running, and away you go.
Well, you know, these things are, we're on the tip and on the edge of so many things, and so many technologies emerge and then are quickly disappeared. I can think of several right offhand that I thought were fascinating and I wanted to know more about, and they're gone. One being Angel Eyes, which was a device that a guy invented. He later got into what he called no man down body armor. And it used 5 lasers and could look through buildings. And then, of course, if you watch The Imposter, the great Philip Dick story with Gary Sinise and the great Matty Stowe, you saw in there that they used a device to look through the buildings, and that they said in that film that, damn, there must be lead paint up there. And we've all been told lead paint is bad, 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 because your children are going to eat it and they're all going to be brain dead. Well, I think that probably more to the truth is that scanning device does indeed exist, and that if we have lead paint on our houses, it will not scan through the lead, and that's why they're discouraging lead paint.
Oh, very interesting.
My house is painted in lead paint.
one of the things that one of my hobbies is watching YouTubes about electricity, and there's this one guy called BigClive.com. I love Big Clive. He lives on the Isle of Man, and he makes his own alcoholic juices by adding sort of vodka with fruit juice. Anyhow, so he takes these things apart, and one of the things he had was a light bulb
that had a microwave detector. And when he took it apart, what really surprised him is that years ago they used to have Doppler shift ultrasonic detectors, didn't they?
Right.
But they didn't last long, and I can tell you why, because I've personally been I've been trying to automate my house. I've got these little devices, and I wanted to have the light come on when I walked into the hallway to switch on the lights in the kitchen and, you know, put on the kettle and things. But the I had this little Doppler effect sonar device that is supposed to be able to measure the speed of somebody walking down the corridor. And determined whether I'm going to the bedroom, anyway, the first thing I did with it was I just set it up so that it would turn on the light. But blow me, this thing just, it just triggered all the time. And you would have a conversation, there's somebody in the kitchen, right? You see, we're both in the kitchen, nobody's in the hallway, and you're having a conversation, and suddenly the light comes on. And then it goes off, and then it just used to come on at random.
Well, the question is, is there something there triggering it, or is it that your circuit is not properly designed?
Yeah, well, here's the thing. It was all, it was just due to the frequencies involved and everything. But anyway, so what he discovered is that they just took a microwave detector and used the same chip that used on the Doppler with a microwave instead of using ultrasonic. So basically, this thing, he says, can walk and look through walls. It can, if you're in the building and you move, this thing will trigger. That was where I was getting to. And so this is on a domestic light bulb. You have a light bulb that anybody in the entire house moves, it can see it. Well, so imagine if you can do imaging with that.
Well, of course. And as you know, Tesla invented a carbon button light bulb that would never wear out. And that sort of thing cannot be allowed. The idea that the technology is so far out ahead of us, I play with a little, kind of a field that I like. I guess scientifically it would be called intruder repulsion. And I contemplate and play with systems for that purpose.
Oh, that's very interesting. Deterrent punishments do you employ? Sort of electric field, magnetic field? Do you wipe their memory, send them back to primary school?
No.
Send them back
basically
3,000 years back in time into a desert,
I'm kind of an inventive guy, and I've always, I've never had a lot of money in my life, so I've always had to build things myself, which I enjoy. And I got into studying trebuchet design, a few years ago, and then I started thinking, trebuchet was developed to defeat defenses that were meant to keep everybody out. And it seemed like a great deal of trouble to go to break down somebody's walls. How about in the modern age? We have a lot of issues right now with those running around calling themselves gouvernemente to control the mind. Government. And they are buying up serious amounts of ammunition of the frangible and more deadly sort. And I'm sure there's a lot of Velocet exploding ammo out there, too. And everyone knows there's no reason that these people would do this for nothing. So they are anticipating some conflict arising at some point with members of the various people running around with taking their hats way too seriously who call themselves government. And being the creative individual I am, I have friends who have asked me, hey, if we decided we were going to try and defend this place from whatever, if things broke down in society, which that looks like they're going to, what would you suggest for preventing anybody getting up our driveway? And, I like little challenges like that. And, I can think of, the old times, let's go back to the trebuchet days. Everybody likes to, run around in their great monstrous 4x4 armor plated if they're law enforcement and whatnot. It seems to me that a soft spot, in a driveway that could be switched on and off could make a large, heavy vehicle like that stop forward motion very quickly. There's all sorts of little things you can do to play in that game in your mind. And so I kind of help some of my friends out with things like that. And then there are more advanced, I try to paint pictures. Okay. I'm alone in the house and, my family is in a hideout and I've got undesirable people, beating at my doors, trying to figure out how to get in, and I'm injured. Maybe I've already taken a hit somewhere with a bullet. What's my last line of defense to make sure that I clear the joint out and nobody gets to my family? You know, things like that. They're interesting concepts to play with. And there are a lot of people out there who have done a lot of thinking along those lines. I was surprised how many there were. So, you know, could we incorporate large electronics into that? Could we build our own lasers? What's out there? And how might we use it to prevent anyone from violating our castle? And I think that the options, one wants to look back in history, much like the pyramid that we're discussing right now, it's often been said that the Ark of the Covenant was also a terrible weapon. You recall that?
Yes. Well, so I haven't finished yet. I mean, okay, so let's go back to the Ark of the Covenant and the legends of the Ark of the Covenant, right? Number one, they said, yes, it can be fearful. Remember we were talking about plasma. Have you ever heard a plasma loudspeaker?
Not that I would know.
Go to YouTube. You can hear them. A Tesla Lightning loudspeaker or something. But basically you can modulate plasma. And you can get, high frequency plasma spark tweeters. Like really, really top hi-fi people have a plasma arc that sings their high frequencies for them because there's no distortion there and you can really modulate it high. So.
Wow.
Okay, so there's another data point. You can modulate sound frequency with a plasma arc. All right, so more data points. All right, it's in a granite box. And, you know, granite's kind of, it's got stuff that can dissipate energy, quartz crystals, and absorb and reflect and stuff. again, going back to our geopolymers, I believe that the granite blocks that are built inside the pyramid were there to hold down the Ark of the Covenant when it was fully in operation because it's an anti-gravity device. It generates gravity waves which push away from itself. Also create a very a very pleasing field. Apparently, that's why a lot of people can't talk about UFO experiences because it's a state of bliss all the time. When you're in a particular state, you know, say when you're very drunk, you can't remember what it was like the next morning, but the next time you get drunk, you can remember. So
yeah.
You can only remember things from the vibration that you're experiencing them. Anyway,
that would make a lot of sense. I haven't drunk for years, so maybe that's why.
So here we go. So we've got more data. So there's more data. So basically, I believe that the granite was either, as you say, it was carved like cheese by a chemical process, or by some kind of lead scalding type gravity. You know, it could well be. It could well be that the Ark of the Covenant itself was used as a transport mechanism for bringing these huge stone blocks to the place by just kind of, you put a whole load on top of it, set the thing going, and it just lifts everything up above it.
Well,
a legend? Is there ever a legend of something that can lift enormous weights? Like that? I've never heard of anything. I don't know if anybody in the chat.
Well, I mean, you can start with a magic carpet. the mysteries that were contained in and came out of Mesopotamia over certain years covered the gamut. And, you know, the Medeans, for instance, consorts of the jinn, carried the staff of power made only of Hollywood, you know. They were able to supposedly cast spells and illusions and conjure illusions, help people that were outnumbered win a war by conjuring illusions of many more people, that sort of thing. So, to answer your question, I think that the possibility of using a pyramid structure to transport the stones, or using that Ark of the Covenant to transport the stones, some sort of anti-gravity generator, is going to allow a remarkable result. If you can get that far, if you've got your little gold box that's capacitor and the angel wings or the spark gap, which makes perfect sense to me, because I think I've even seen a film, an old science fiction film, where they had exactly that. There were threaded rollers that both of those angels were on, and if they turned a crank at one end, it moved them vis-a-vis one another.
There you go. So you imagine an ancient mechanism. It would be, right. And these things are also beautifully made, aren't they? It's like, this is a machine that is not built to wear out. This is a machine that is built to last thousands of years. And just even for that, you got to say, wow.
Well, and where is it? You know, who has it? What do they do with it?
The first thing that came into my head was Smithsonian. Right, investigate.
Well, who owns the Smithsonian? They took off with everything from the Grand Canyon, too. I'd like to know how to harden copper so it's harder than steel. That's what the guys in the Grand Canyon had, all the large orientals they found there. And, you know, they had copper weapons that were harder than steel. Well, gee. And Cliff High's data is talking about a new copper process that will allow copper to be harder than steel and also be used much like gold or silver as superconductors. I don't know if you follow Cliff High's data and his alternate.
I do. And I'm, you know, just well, as you're speaking, I'm thinking, copper and GANS. You know, I bought a whole load of...
Well, there you go. And I've studied cash. I get all the workshop emails. I've not been able to keep up recently, but
you
I
get
have
it. I mean, because personally, I don't really get it yet. Because, you know, I hear him talking about it, but I don't hear him, I hear him talking about what people say about it or what people are doing, but I haven't heard anything that really kind of, tickles my science bud that says, we've got 15 minutes, so let's see if you can nutshell the nugget of plasma, and again, hook it back to this ancient technology and ancient knowledge that we're now re-expanding into our today's world.
Well, I'll relate to you one thing. I have a friend who was with the Department of Defense for many, many, many years, and actually probably is never going to be entirely out. But this friend of mine talked about... plasma uses and also the idea that the idea is that if we have a use of plasma, and that there are several grades of plasma use, and once you get to say grade 3, if you're in the ordinary world, that's all there is to plasma. And if you're on the inside, there's all kinds of things that you do with plasma. And I think that we are still struggling in this world, and that is a negotiation point. One of the reasons that I think that, believe it or not, going and speaking with the Queen about the Dutchman is that humanity is stumbling along at this moment, and right now we have enough changes coming at us that stumbling really isn't required. I think we're going to do enough of that on our own. So why don't we try to walk a line together, elites and regular people, and let the elites be seen as at least willing to recognize that things have changed, and here you go, this will help you out. If we aren't going to be able to wipe out 90% of you, here, use this technology and don't just spoil everything everywhere you go. I think there's that moment that's come about. And I think that us trying to design the way that the pyramid and a plasma ejection might be used from it is, again, support of what I'm saying, that we're at this moment where we need to just unlock some of this and let it go, because we're at a point on this planet where people are not going to be led to endless war anymore, and they're not going to put up with money that's constantly degraded unless you're a bank, in which case they'll pay you more and more that they take from everyone else. Things have to change. And I think that the opportunity exists to release a bunch of knowledge that has been held very secret, knowledge not only about technology, but about who really lives with us on this planet. Why is there a desert where the pyramid is? And a better question, what's under that desert at various depths?
Indeed, why are there deserts?
If there's someone living
in the first place, why are there deserts in certain places of the world that might, you know, be a grid point? Or potentially a very large area of population, perhaps in a long period long ago?
Well, yeah.
You know?
Where did they go, and did they decide to sort of pull in the carpet when they went down underground? Because the living on the surface of a planet is chaotic. If you can find those great underground caverns, Corey Good and whatnot are talking about, you can become a townie, if you will, and simply go below with everybody else. Personally, I kind of like the wild ride, on the surface. I've become rather fond of it. But I think that there is a moment where the two need to touch their fingers, like that famous painting, you know, where God touches finger to man. Man should touch fingers with man, quit worrying about God, and see if we can work together. And releasing a lot of this technology would go a step that way. Now, one could argue, gee, if we taught everybody how to run their cars and everything they wanted on hydrogen, we'd have roads everywhere, the place would be destroyed, blah, 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 blah. Now, maybe 25 years ago, if you'd have dumped it on the population all at once, you might have had that response. Now, you've got a couple of generations of kids that now, you know, they read the food labels, they pick up their garbage, they're not going to go out and just try to cut it all, which is the name of a book about the logging that went on the west coast of Washington State. I think that we're at a point where money has worn rather thin. Before, I mean, in my generation, being 61, right, I was going to grow up, get rich, and live like a king and go out and do great things. Never gave a thought to my place in the universe. You know, was the earth finite? It was about chew it up, go get what you want, and be a man. And now I don't think we're raising that same attitude. The only people that seem to be clinging to that attitude of, go, you know, tromp over anything you get, you need to get what you want, or the famous in America gift pack, there used to be this little gift pack you could buy. It was a clear plastic cover on a box, and it said on the top of the box, it said how to succeed in business. And when you open the box, there's a 10-inch brass screw and the word everyone written on the mounting for the brass screw.
sad.
That was what they tried to tell us capitalism was about. And I think that the lies have run to full circle to the point where they're coming back now and revealing themselves. The laws have been passed to the point where they're fictions, and their debts they're trying to lay. Nobody believes it. Nobody with a brain for one second thinks that a bunch of guys who couldn't fly a Cessna with box cutters did 911. You know, we're at a point where we've reached the end of the road, with the wool being pulled over our eyes, with technology being hidden, we're smart enough that if we do not have a war zone to live through, as is being trounced upon many people on this planet right now, we will figure it out. We are humans. It's what we do. And if you came across a guy who was interviewed on Project Camelot, Kerry did it with him. I'm trying to remember his name. He's a financial guy. He's not Saudi, not Turkish, Kurd.
Fali or something.
Yes. He talks about how when they kill people, three generations later, they come back. And that the people who plan over these long periods of time have learned that their enemies that they kill will return. So whether you want to call that karma or not, it does give the future a bit of predictability. And if you are designing a future for a planet with this many people on it, the obvious thing in my mind is, why not write a good one? I mean, who are your writers, elite? Who are your writers, draconian reptilians, who have not invented or developed or made better one thing since they began just marching over everyone else? Where does the progress for all life come from when one branch of life decides it owns all of the rest of life and can do whatever it wants with it? That seems to me to be a swan song for a planet. And I think we're seeing that, and I think it's time for it to change. And I think that if the people that are seeing them, their control systems threatened were to think about it a little bit, they have the opportunity to emerge as good guy heroes by bringing this stuff out, or scurry about as criminals on the run while they're hunted down. Easy choice to me.
That's right. So so here we are at the end of this strange little multi-dimensional journey.
Yeah.
For the last couple of hours. It's been interesting, hasn't it?
Been that long?
Yeah. We're at the top.
Wow.
Yeah, I know. Time traveler. We have been involved in time travel technology. We have been in the past and then the future. And sometimes we don't remember how long we spent in the past. I'm sure that's happened to you.
A few times.
We will speak some more.
I would enjoy that, and I would love to, if the opportunity ever arose, to get on with Wynn Keach and Simon at some point, because I listen to Wynn and know that he's a good friend of Simon's, and Wynn and I could talk about some things off the air that might be real interesting. There's a couple things on the air I'd like to talk to him about, because there's a whole industry that could happen if I could find the brains for one key piece.
Well, I mean, Wynn may be your man, because he is certainly, he's certainly got his finger on the pulse of industry, and if he's got an idea, he can make it, he can implement it.
You know, well, I emailed him what I wanted to do, and perhaps we will get together at some point. I like to see things take quantum leaps.
It'd be awesome. I mean, it really would be awesome to be able to connect people together, invent things, bring them into humanity's domain, just through the fact of an internet radio show. I think that would be
marvelous use. And I started something on my birthday, my last birthday. I told my family I don't want any gifts. From now on my birthday, I'm going to give the world something. Mm-hmm. And I did on my last birthday. And I have mind-walked it all over the place. I work in the industry where the equipment would come from, and it's a $1 trillion industry waiting to happen that would solve an enormous number of problems, and I simply need a piece of technology that I think Wynn Keach or someone like him could figure it out quite well, and then I wouldn't have to stumble around trying to rediscover their wheel.
Well, there's an interesting little nugget that we can pin on the wall, say, anyone got a solution to this? Until that time, Glenn Murphy, it's been just a wonderful, delightful wonder. It feels like I've known you forever. I probably knew you then. You'll probably know me in the future.
We could go down that road another time, JP. There is much that we don't say contained in what we do, and I'm sure you've heard me loud and clear. So until we meet again, I greatly enjoyed it, and I thank you for the time and the opportunity, sir.
Thank you very much. This has been Ever Beyond on Ever Beyond Radio. I haven't got any guests tomorrow, but we'll see who's calling in. All right, thank you very much. Good night, everybody. Because it's July the 4th tomorrow, there's no Frank Jordan group for today, but I've got their private recording from yesterday, which I'll play now, so it won't be live, so I won't take calls or anything. But thank you, everybody, and that's what you can look forward to.